Well, we're back after recess. I forgot what happened. I think a case got taken off the docket, so we had a little extra time. And so I appreciate y'all waiting until we could get back. We have this one case scheduled for oral argument, and several more cases are scheduled to be submitted today, but they do not involve oral argument, so we'll be conferencing on them. So we're glad to have you, and if you're ready to start, I will ask the clerk to call the case and announce the lawyers.
The court will now call Ernest Ross versus the state, and may it please the court, Ms. Sarah Rowland to argue for the appellant, Ms. Andrea Simmons to argue for the state.
Ms. Rowland, are you ready to proceed?
May it please the court, counsel. We're back here, as you know, Justice Meyer.
I'm vaguely familiar with this case, Ms.
Little bit. Little bit. On Mr. Ross again. And this was a punishment retrial. Quite frankly, some of the issues are the same. Some are very different, though, based on what happened in the retrial on the punishment case. I would like to spend my time with you on three of the issues, those being what I'm going to call the juvenile judgment issue, the 1981 issue, the fingerprint issue, and then the mistrial issue. And I'd like to start with the juvenile judgment issue and first of all talk about the state obviously can prove a prima facie case to connect a defendant with a judgment if you have the judgment and you connect that person with it. Here, as opposed to the last go-round, we have an interesting issue in that the fingerprint issue comes into play a little bit in this one. I'd like to start off by talking about the facts that we know based on this trial for the juvenile judgment issue. And at first, I'd like to point out on the state's brief at page 11, I think it just misquotes the record. The state cites on page 11 that Kish testified that there was a certification or transfer order in the file. The reality is he specifically testified that there was not, and that's it. Volume 5, reporter's record, beginning at page 203 and continues through 205. So Kish specifically testified that there was no such thing in the file. He had looked. He didn't know where it was, but there should be one, was what Kish testified to. Secondly, Gail Joseph, two clerks were called. Gail Joseph, who was the juvenile head clerk, and Don Smith, who's the district court records clerk. Gail Joseph testified that she performed a search not just by cause number, but also by name of Ernest Lynn Ross and came up with nothing. And she consulted with Don Smith, too. The best they were ever able to come up with on computer or in hard copy form was what records clerk Don Smith came with, which was admitted for the trial court's consideration and which is part of the record in this case. Clear that there is absolutely no certification or transfer order in the file. The state actually admitted to the trial court that there was no certification or transfer order in the file, and the state conceded, actually, that there was no separate juvenile file, that everything was contained in the file that was admitted. And that concession is located at volume 5 in the reporter's record, page 154. Here are the issues now with regard to the judgment. We know that the date of birth is incorrect on the judgment. It's listed at 2/15/64. There's evidence before the trial court and an admission by the state that Mr. Ross's actual date of birth is 2/15/65, which would have made him a juvenile at the time. It becomes a question, though, when you're considering can they prove beyond a reasonable doubt this prior and link this one individual to it. We also know that the name, Mr. Ross's name, is misspelled on the fingerprint card that Mr. Kish took. Difference this time than last time, there was no attack whatsoever the first go-round on the fingerprints. It was basically admitted by agreement. in this case, there's absolutely defects in these judgments sufficient to overcome any kind of presumption of regularity. And I want to start out by saying that the state's, in its brief, seems to rely wholly, almost wholly, on Moss versus State, which Justice Holman's going to be very familiar with. And our opinion, appellant's opinion, is that that reliance is very misplaced, as is any kind of reliance on Ellis. And the reason that that's misplaced, in both of those cases, that was initially what the argument was, that the lack of a transfer order in the file means the judgment's void and it's no good. However, in both of those cases, there was a supplemental record filed, supplemental clerk's records filed, that did contain the transfer order, the certification order. And in fact, in Moss, the appellant Moss actually agreed that that was an accurate copy. There's documentation in the Moss file, according to that opinion, that Moss had specifically waived her right to an examining trial, and there's a recitation in that judgment that was signed off on by the trial court that Moss had been so certified. In the papers of the file that we have, there's nothing. There's no signing off on by the trial court or anything. There are three, as this court knows, there are three references made by either the prosecuting attorney at the time or the defendant's attorney at the time. There's no judgment, there's no formal judgment or recitation by the trial court either in the docket entries or anywhere amongst the papers of the court indicating that appellant was ever certified in this case. So the issue becomes different, and those are maybe the closest in-kind cases that you have, but I'll submit to you, I have not found a case that deals with this particular issue where there hasn't been a supplemental record filed where it says, yeah, here it is. We didn't get it filed the first time, or it was lost because of this, or it was destroyed, but we have it now and everybody agrees with it. That seems to be the posture of the case law on this particular issue. Same for Ellis. They filed it later on in a supplemental record. The most recent case that I found dealing with juvenile issues is the Court of Criminal Appeals case Moon versus State, and it's not it doesn't directly apply to this case because the issue there was whether the Court of Appeals had conducted an appropriate review of any of the juvenile court's transfer order. So that's not exactly applicable here, but I'll say the problem transfers over to this case. And the problem is nobody can review any kind of transfer order to decide whether, first of all, whether it existed, and second of all, to decide whether the requirements of 54.02 of the Family Code were complied with, that requires the juvenile court to state specifically in the order or on the record its reasons for transfer. And the idea in calling the records clerks this time versus last time was, we're in a position, Mr. Ross was in a position where you've got to prove a negative, because his position essentially is that it didn't happen, and disagrees with the recitations, the vague references in the record by the state's attorney and his. And so how do you prove a negative other than to say it didn't happen and to call every conceivable person, records person, to say it's not there, and, hey, we don't think it's ever been there, according to the state of Texas, because everything is in the file that you have under 17176C. It's just not there. I'll move on to the fingerprints issue unless there's questions about the juvenile issue.
What about these examining trial records?
Yes, sir.
Ms. Rowland?
Sure.
Both of those records seem to indicate that there was at least conscious contest joined by the state and the defense counsel as to whether or not Mr. Ross should be certified as an adult in these, as a consequence of these criminal prosecutions, and both of them refer to him being certified as an adult. And do you reach the level of a prima facie case in terms of that those documents which are included in the records that you submitted as
yes,
part
sir.
Of that lower court case? I'm interested in how you define those away.
Sure. I would say there's a difference in those documents versus others. There's not the first docket entry, I'll say this on the court sheet, is that there was an examining trial. And Mr. Cobb and Mr. Whitlock, who were the prosecutor and the defense lawyer at the time, both mentioned either reviewing certification proceedings or saying specifically this person has been so certified. I think the problem is there's no evidence actually of that containing
records the attorneys made in terms of what they noted in their presentation to the court. You would contend is not a sufficient finding in a court record.
I would contend it's different than like what we have in other cases where you have an actual judgment that's signed off on by the court and or that's signed off on by a defendant, like a waiver of a jury trial, for example. I would contend there's a difference in references to and an actual court saying there was an affirmative waiver of a jury trial and a defendant saying, yes, I want to waive a jury trial. Yes, sir.
There was some mention, and I can't find it now, but
that's
okay. Possibly Mr. Whitlock or some trial attorney checked out the record and didn't bring it back?
In the first, in the very first trial, and so not this one, the first one, there was a mention that the state's attorney at that time who was trying the case, Bill Schultz, had checked out the file,
okay.
Which we now know is the file that's in the record, the 17176C. And we know that because that file was imaged. The problem, quite frankly, is the physical file I may still be on Bill Schultz's desk, I don't know, but the actual contents of the file were imaged when they were received, according to Don Smith, the records clerk, and so that's actually what was printed out and what's contained in the record.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
Microfiche image of what was the original.
Correct. Yes, sir. The original actual physical file, who knows where at this point in time. With regard to the fingerprint testimony, this is an area, quite frankly, where law meets science. And there's lots of those issues, and they're really quite fascinating, I think. Just because, and this court well knows, just because we've always done something one way in the past doesn't mean it's the right way to do it now or in the future. And the best kind of examples that I could think of as far as that go are arson evidence, shaken baby prosecutions. The law seems to be slower than the science advances, and I think that that's absolutely true in the case with fingerprints. Forward is still, as of this morning, to the best of my knowledge, the closest case on point, and it is distinguishable for the reason, and I think for the very important reason, that there was no Daubert hearing conducted at all in that case, and that, quite frankly, as a defense lawyer, that's troubling. Anytime there's no actual expert hearing conducted anytime. We know, I'll rely, I guess, on the arguments in the brief. Didn't realize I was already taking so much time, but I do want to point the justice's attention. I made a chart this morning with regard to the motion for mistrial. I'm a visual person. That's what helps me. So sequentially, this is what you have in time. On April 17th, Kim Lopez testified about an extraneous offense. The defense absolutely had a hearing outside the presence of the jury and said you shouldn't be able to consider any identification stuff. Lopez made an in-court identification, pointed to Mr. Ross, and there was a photo ID that was made 733 days later that she testified about and which was admitted contemporaneously as States Exhibit 64 in front of the jury. Then you have Joanne Fira, who testifies. She makes a surprise in-court ID because she's never made one before. We know it's a surprise ID because the state's the one who stands up and says, oh, Judge, we need to have you instruct the jury to disregard that. He does that at that point and polls the jury. Then we have three more witnesses who testify. Then we have April 18th, 19th, 20th, which were long holiday Easter weekends. Then we come back, and the judge all of a sudden says, I've reconsidered, and now you should disregard the photo ID that was of Ms. Lopez. I've likened that. That's not just an improper comment. That's not just an improper question. When you point to somebody and say, that's the person who did it, that becomes very prejudicial and hard to remove that from the juror's mind. I likened it in the brief to the erroneous admission of polygraph results. In my mind, it rises to that level. It's not just the improper question. You couldn't expect those jurors to forget that or put it out of their mind or for it not to have made an impression after Ms. Fira and after you have three more witnesses and over the long weekend. So that's the contention there, and I see I'm out of time.
Thank you, counsel. We will hear from counsel for Appalee.
Good morning. Andrea Simmons on behalf of the state counsel. I would like to start off first addressing the juvenile certification issue as well. This issue, as Ms. Rowland pointed out, was an issue that we debated during the first trial. Although we did have the physical trial folder from the 1981 conviction during Ross's first trial, it was not found when it came time to retry punishment. However, all of the documents contained within the file we used were on the microfilm, which were admitted at this retrial on punishment. Within that file, the trial court specifically relied on several inferences and statements made within other documents relating to Ross having been certified as an adult. And in fact, the trial judge went to the specific point of outlining exactly which inferences within those documents that he was relying upon to find that Ross had in fact been certified as an adult. And in one of those, he commented that the motion was actually filed on appellant's behalf through his attorney, and that he almost considered that motion a concession by admitting that he had in fact been certified as an adult. Furthermore, his attorney was Mr. Tom Whitlock, who also in his statements indicated that he had reviewed the examining trial transcript, that Mr. Ross had in fact been certified as an adult, and the state's documents as well indicate that. And all of these facts are the same facts that were relied on the first appeal, in which this court found that the state met its original burden. So what we're left with now at the second trial on punishment is whether or not Ross was able to meet the rebuttable presumption of showing irregularity. And it appears that the argument is that because there was no physical certification order within that file, that they've thereby proved their rebuttable presumption, and that we currently have no clerks located in the clerk's offices at Denton County who can find that actual paper. The state would argue that the inferences contained within the documents, which were before the trial court and are before this court on appeal as part of the record, are sufficient to prove that, in fact, Mr. Ross was certified as an adult, and would argue that Mr. Ross has failed to sustain his burden of showing a rebuttable presumption of any void judgment or irregularity in the judgment that would have stricken away the jurisdiction of the district court over his proceedings in cause number 17176C. If no one has any other questions as to that.
I have a question about the last one that's listed on page 17 in your brief.
Yes, sir.
The motion for examining trial also indicates that appellant was detained as a juvenile in that paragraph. That appears to be, to me as I read it, to state that the hearing that was held in the 158th District Court determined that appellant should be certified for trial as an adult.
Absolutely. And in fact, it states that the 158th Judicial was sitting as the juvenile court.
I see that. But what I'm looking for is what court record sustains that was the decision made in the 158th court. In other words, it says if the judge sitting as a juvenile court certified to the 211th Judicial District Court for the purpose of being handled as an adult. Was there an order?
The sentence immediately following that states, and that at the hearing in the 158th Judicial Court sitting as juvenile, appellant was certified to the 211th Judicial Court for purposes of being handled as an adult.
And that's what I'm looking for. Is where you said it was certified. Does that mean an order was entered? What was entered?
Yeah, I think was certified shows that they had the proper certification process mandated under the Texas Family Code underwent to have come to a final determination that he in fact had been certified to be stand trial as an adult.
Don't have an order, counsel. That's what I'm looking for.
There is no order.
Then there's no order from the 158th court in this part of your briefing. That's just a matter that the court had a hearing and then he's certified over to the 211th, but we don't have a document that is an order of the 158th court stating that.
That is true. Okay. And that's the crux of the argument, is whether or not we can find sufficient evidence that Mr. Ross was certified as an adult absent the physical order, which the state has conceded we do not have an order from the courts for certification. And so the state's argument is that the references contained within these extrinsic documents are sufficient to prove that, in fact, there had been an order. He had been, in fact, certified as an adult, and the process had been gone through, as indicated by these notations, which were relied upon by the trial court, and that those would have been sufficient for the state to have met their showing of proof of the prior conviction. And the state would also argue that the showing that this was found in the first trial, all of these same references that we're looking at on page 17 of my brief were basically the same arguments and inferences we made in the first appeal, in which this court found that it was sufficient proof for the state to have met its initial burden. And so the only difference the second time around is whether or not Mr. Ross was able to meet his rebuttable presumption, as Ms. Rowland indicates, of trying to prove the negative. And the proof of the negative, the difference here, is what Ross did was bring in these clerks to say, we can't find the files. Really what that boils down to is coming kind of full circle back to where we started, as we don't have an order. We didn't have an order the first time. We don't have an order now, but we have documents within the file that are court documents, and some of those filed by Ross's own attorney or notations by his attorney indicating that, in fact, Ross was properly certified and that there were no issues at that time with him being certified as an adult. And so I don't think the lack of our current county clerks finding the actual paper or an additional juvenile file meets appellant's burden of rebutting the presumption. Does that make sense? And moving on to the fingerprint issue, on Mr. Kish's testimony as to fingerprints, I think Ms. Rowland is correct in stating that science continues to evolve, and as it evolves, often the law is slow to play catch up on some of these things, but it's a hard task, a daunting task to do with as quick as science moves and technology. And although fingerprint has been around a long time, and there have been some concerns raised about fingerprints, as Ms. Rowland indicated in her brief regarding an article that was the trial court took judicial notice of certain pages. There is more research to be done, but I think even as her own article indicates, although there may be research that can be done and hopefully practices in the future that can make each process better, as we hope all processes become better till we have a more final and firm answer to everything. Until that time, this is the best situation that we do have, is the technique that we're currently using, and that it's not inadmissible because science has failed and research has failed to make it better. The article she's relied on basically is just asking for continued research and analysis of the process used by law enforcement. And so in the meantime, while that's just an advisory opinion given through a research project, it is not the law, and Texas still does rely upon the fingerprints as a matter of common knowledge that's been upheld by several of the courts in Texas. What did happen in this trial with Kish was that he did not have his work validated, which is one of the factors that is part of the fingerprint analysis. There's analysis, comparison, examination, and verification when comparing fingerprints. And although we've made it through the first three, the verification procedure, Kish admitted that he did not have his work verified by any other colleague, and did note that other people could come to different opinions in looking at the same set of prints. And basically the state's argument on that is that's going to go to the weight and credibility of the evidence and the testimony for the jury to weigh when they're determining what weight to give his testimony. And all of that was before them, what was required, and that verification was one of those factors, and that it was not done in this case. But they had plenty of other testimony from Mr. Kish to rely on to show that he in fact had been doing this for years, he had been trained in it, what his comparison specifically was in this case, that he found more than seven factors, which his normal number is seven, but he found more than that in this case, and they were able to weigh his credibility and his testimony to determine that it was sufficient to link Mr. Ross to those fingerprints. And moving on, are there any questions as to fingerprints that I could address for anyone on the panel?
The focus of your argument, counsel, seems to be that what we're dealing with on this fingerprint issue is not so much the conclusive nature of the testimony of Mr. Kish, but the fact that his testimony was admissible in terms of the trial court's job as a gatekeeper on allowing expert testimony. But then it's up to the jury to decide what weight to give that testimony.
Yes. I think that as the gatekeeper function, the trial court was in the position to determine whether there was enough to go forward for the jury to then determine and weigh that testimony, evidence, and the credibility of that, and that was properly admitted and before the jury, and based on their conclusion, they found that sufficient despite the lack of the verification process.
Thank you.
Finally, as to the misidentification issue, the state, Ms. Rowland has this paper up here, which pretty much goes through the timeline pretty well of when Ms. Fira and Lopez were given the opportunity to try to identify persons from a lineup, photo lineup. It was a long time after the actual offense had been committed. These two ladies had in fact been attacked at a car wash. When they didn't give the man their cell phone, they were attacked. Their car was stolen and their cell phone, and both women were injured. The man left and then rolled the car. The way the police ended up with this photo lineup containing a picture of Mr. Ross is through an informant who was working with police and gave them a tip that Ross was in fact present that night when this incident occurred, as well as several other incidences that occurred in Duncanville that night. After they've made that lineup, and during the first trial, Ms. Lopez ID'd Mr. Ross in court. Ms. Fira never did make an ID on the photographs or in court, but then at the second trial, she did identify Mr. Ross as the man who attacked her. During the new trial on punishment, and the state immediately notified the court that was an erroneous identification. She had never previously identified Mr. Ross as the person, although she could give a vague description of the man, but she had not previously identified him, so we were not trying to get that before the court. The jury, as Ms. Rowland has indicated, did receive an instruction, and they were polled as to whether or not they could ignore her testimony where she identified Ross. In fact, each of the jurors indicated that they, in fact, could put that aside and move forward. The court, however, did allow the testimony of Ms. Lopez that she had previously identified appellant and that she could identify him now in court. After three other witnesses testified and the long holiday weekend, the trial judge did come back and reverse his own holding and say that he was going to take away, exclude the testimony, identification testimony of Ms. Lopez. And in abundance of caution, that he felt that that was not sufficient facts for him to have given a warrant, had he heard those facts. Therefore, he did not think it was sufficient to for an identification purposes in trial. And although he did not poll the jury the second time with Ms. Lopez, he did in fact give an instruction, and an instruction was also included in the punishment jury charge, which specifically told the jury to disregard the identification of Ms. Lopez. And they'd already agreed they could on Ms. Fira. So the state's contention is that although if there was error there, it was not, there was no harm from the error, and that the jury would have followed the instructions given, and there was no indication that they would not have. And furthermore, that the testimony and identification by Ms. Lopez and Fira were regarding who attacked them at the car wash, which is really not the basis for the underlying offense for which he was at trial, and that his punishment was also supported by multiple other instances of extraneous offenses which could have substantiated his conviction. I see that I'm out of time. So I would thank the court for your time, and I hope that you'll affirm the trial court's decision.
Thank you. Do we have rebuttal from Ms. Rowland?
Yes, ma'am, thank you. Just briefly. First of all, I want to be clear with regard to the juvenile issue. The argument is similar but different and distinguishable from last time. Here we have the fingerprint issue, which I'll talk about in just a second. There's a difference in the way Mr. Ross's name is spelled and his date of birth, as well as there was affirmative evidence of the non-existence of records from two separate clerks. So similar argument, but not the same in that there was more this time. With regard to the fingerprint evidence, you can read the transcript. I know you have with regard to the 705 hearing. Yeah, law oftentimes is slow to catch up with science. What the trial court took judicial notice of was a 2009 publication. This is a trial in 2013, 14. This is a strengthening forensic sciences. The section that the trial court took judicial notice of on friction ridge analysis goes through whether or not ACE-5, the acronym, is actually reliable or not, and it concludes, bottom line, that it's not. That, yeah, we need to do a whole bunch more stuff as far as formulating this procedure to make sure that it's reliable, but the bottom line conclusion is that it's not reliable. So if you go through the reliability factors, whether it's accepted as valid by the scientific community, according to this publication and articles cited therein, it's not reliable by the scientific community. It says as much in that article. Whether there's literature supporting or rejecting it, the defense offered the literature that rejected it. The clarity which it can be explained, the rate of error, the publication talks about the rate of error. The availability of others to test and verify, and quite frankly, that's the problem here. And the difference between Mr. Kish's testimony and that in Forward was that in Forward, the expert said that it doesn't matter that I didn't do the verification procedure, I never have, it doesn't change the results. There was no indication or statement like that made by Kish at all in this. In fact, the statement was the converse, that that's a necessary step and that I didn't do it. The qualifications of the expert and the skill and experience of the expert, you can read in the 705 hearing. The truth of the matter is he hadn't been subjected to many 705 hearings. The truth of the matter is it had been since 2009, the year of this publication, since Mr. Kish had had any training at all on that topic. The rest of the arguments, I think, are well expounded upon in the brief, so I'll say with regard to the mistrial, this is a punishment trial, a punishment retrial. The offense for which Ms. Lopez and Ms. Fira testified was an extraneous offense, which the state absolutely used to try to increase Mr. Ross's punishment. Ross's argument during trial was that it wasn't him, it was Cedric Autry who had committed this offense. There wasn't anybody else that identified him. The posture and the way the facts are in this case absolutely show that it was prejudicial.
Ms. Rowland, I read that while there might be some charge about credibility, that both Stevens and Farmer testified that there was contact with them, with the defendant, on the night and of the occasion when the SUV was stolen and rolled.
That is true. Those were co-defendants, and I would submit to the court that there are credibility issues with regard to that. Specifically, factually, they both also testified that Mr. Ross wasn't dirty or wasn't hurt either, which you would expect, I guess.
No, he was sweaty and anxious.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I think what you have, though, is the problem. That's different. Co-defendant testimony is very different from a civilian witness who sits in a courtroom.
I agree with you.
Says it's that man. And so that's the argument. Probably have 10 seconds left if there's a question.
Well, I had a question going back to the article that was admitted. Was it admitted for the record only?
It was admitted for the record only, yes, ma'am. During the 705 hearing, it did not go in front of the jury. And certainly I could ask the Court of Appeals to take judicial notice of the full publication. I will quite candidly tell you that there is one section in here. There are lots of sections that deal with different kinds of sciences. There's a section in here specifically related to friction ridge analysis, the fingerprinting, and that's the section of which the trial court took judicial notice. It's an interesting read all throughout, but the only relevant part is the friction ridge analysis. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you both. Excellent arguments and briefs and difficult issues. And we appreciate your appearing today and your arguments. Your case is submitted and you're excused. Thank you very much. And we'll stand at recess. We'll adjourn. How about that?